I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Luigi Boitani. He's chair of the Large Carnivore Initiative for Europe, LCIE. He's also a professor in the Department of Animal and Human Biology at the University of Rome. Professor Boitani is a world-leading authority on wolves and has written many papers and books centered on wolf biology, wolf management, and human attitudes towards wolves. Today we're going to talk about wolves in Europe and also the Large Carnivore Initiative for Europe. So first off, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
So why don't we start with the Large Carnivore Initiative for Europe? What is it?
Sure. It's a group of experts, and it's part of the larger Species Survival Commission, it's called, which is the largest commission of the IUCN, International Union for Conservation of Nature. So it's this Species Survival Commission is by far the largest commission of the IUCN and includes about 10,000 experts on different taxa, mammals, birds, invertebrates, and plants across all over the world. Within this Species Survival Commission, there are several smaller group of experts, and our group is quite small, actually. It's about 45 people. It includes some of the best experts on large carnivores in Europe. Not all the experts, though. There are many others, of course, but we don't want this group to grow too large. It would be then very difficult to manage it. So it's about 45. We cover basically the five largest, I should say six, actually, six largest carnivores in Europe, which is the bear, brown bear, the wolf, the Eurasian lynx, the Iberian lynx, which is the most endangered cat in the world, and then includes the wolverine, and includes the golden jackal. Maybe many people will wonder why we cover golden jackal, because they have been expanding into Europe in the last couple of decades, and now they are present in the eastern part of Europe and sending dispersing animals as far as Estonia in the north, in Switzerland, a couple in France too. So they are gaining grounds across Europe. So these are the species we are dealing with. And the people, the expert part of the large carnivores actually cover all countries of Europe. So we feel pretty confident that we can answer almost any question on large carnivores in Europe. And we provide our expertise and our policy support to the national governments, and most important, to the European Commission based in Brussels.
So a lot of let's leave aside the jackal for a minute and talk about some of the others. How I know this is a really vague question, but how are predators, large predators, doing in Europe in general? When somebody from the United States thinks of Europe, we think of a lot of metropolises and some smaller forests, but we don't think of the sort of large range that carnivores quite often require.
Yeah, I think there is a misunderstanding of two things. First of all, the kind of habitat that large carnivores requires, and the second is misperceptions of what Europe actually is. So about the first one, I should say that most of the species that we are talking about, the brown bear, the wolf, the lynx, they are able to live very close to humans. They are very opportunistic, and if you don't kill them, they would be in your garden. And whether they are dangerous or not, that's another question. Whether they cause a lot of damage, that's another question. But I mean, if you look at the issue from the point of view of the ecology of this species, they are perfectly able to coexist very, very close to humans. The other misperception is that Europe is an overcrowded continent filled with people and beautiful cities, and that's all. It's partly true. Europe is about 500 million people, so it's a lot of people. But there are also a lot of wilderness areas, which means, I shouldn't say wilderness because it's not true wilderness, but it's a wild areas without people. So that there is plenty of room for nature and, of course, for prey. And we have some of the largest number of, I call it the wolf prey, but actually they are deer, moose, or rather large ungulates. And then, of course, we have room also for the carnivores who feed on these animals. So, for example, take the example of Italy. Everybody think, you know, Italy is an overcrowded country. Everybody knows Rome, Florence, Venice, you know, just beautiful cities. Nobody thinks that there is nature, too. The majority of our 60 million people, Italy is a small country, and we have 60 million people, the majority of them are along the coast and in the plains. But the mountain backbones of Italy, which is the Apennines, that runs all across Italy from the north to the southern tip, they are pretty much wild. It's not true wilderness because they are wild because they have been abandoned by people living out of mountain agriculture. Nobody wants to be a farmer up in the mountains where life is really hard. So everybody left. I mean, all those who are living in the mountains left the mountains and are now living in much more comfortable areas along the coast. So there is plenty of room for a huge population of wild boars, red deer, roe deer, fallow deer, and of course there is plenty of room for carnivores who feed on them. And so that's why in Italy we can afford to have some 2,000 wolves, which is a huge number. In some protected areas they are very high density, in some others are lower density, but we can still have wolves all around. And when I speak to in U.S., for example, about this, people just don't believe it. You say, really, you do have wolves in Italy? Yes, because the North American people have this idea that wolves are the beast of the wilderness. They are far away from humans. They hunt wolves, and if they see a humans, they give it a thought of killing it and eating it, which is actually a misperception, or at least it's not a misperception. It's just looking at the wolf only from one eye, from one angle. Wolves can live very close to human. If they have something to eat, they are on their own. We have a wolf pack which has a den just right near the main airport of Rome. And we do have a true wild wolf some 20 kilometers, which is 15 miles, even less, from the Colosseum. And nobody has ever been hurt, or no humans have been threatened by these animals. Certainly, these animals can kill livestock, and that's another problem. It's a big problem, so we have to solve that, or at least we have to prevent or mitigate that, and we are working on that. I made the case of Italy, but I could do any other. Spain has an estimate 2,500 wolves. Romania has an estimated 5,000 wolves. Or let's think of another country that you may be familiar with, Sweden, for example. Sweden, a few decades ago, had only 100 brown bear left. And this brown bear were really, they were hunted, and the population was going down. When the government decided that they had something to do with this small population and probably protect it and see how to they could be managed more, in an ecologically sound approach. So they put the population in the hands of biologists, and biologists never stopped the hunting of this population. Actually, they continued the hunting, And hunting was very important and still very important, because then the hunters take pride of the presence of bear, and they have a return on hunting bears. So they want a bear population. Well, to make the story very short, now Sweden has an estimated 3,200 bear. So they are all over. They are all over the country. And it's a beautiful story of coexistence again between humans and large carnivores. Then I can hear some of the North American audience say, but what kind of bear they are? Are they really the grizzly? No, the grizzly is a North American type, but this is the same species. Ursus arctos is the brown bear. It's a huge animal, and it's huge in North America as well as in Europe. And in Italy, we have done even a reintroduction of brown bear. Up in the north, where, you know, everybody knows the Alps, skiing resorts and all that. But in one smaller region of the Alps called Trentino, it's actually not a region, it's called a province, the local government, they had the local brown bear population going down almost to extinction. Actually, it was functionally extinct. There were only two left, and they were not breeding. So they decided to reinforce the population. They brought a dozen brown bear from Slovenia, and now the population is estimated to be around 60 and still growing. And by growing, is sending dispersing males into Austria, Germany, Switzerland, other provinces of Italy. Not all these areas receiving bears are very happy with that, but you know, the bear is a protected species in Italy, so we don't have any case yet of poaching on this small population, which is a very interesting story.
Well, a couple things. One is, as soon as I asked the question, I realized how silly it was, because I live in far northern California, and I live in a town of 2,500 people, 8,000 people, and I see bears every single day most of the year. So, yeah. Of course, these non-humans can, many species of non-humans, I mean, the bears will come and fall asleep on your porch. So many times they can. So my question about bears or wolves living among humans was in some ways kind of silly. Let's go back to, you've said there haven't been any cases of the brown bears being poached in Italy. And can we talk a little bit about the human attitudes toward wolves? Because I know here where I live, one of the neighbors shot a bear because it was drinking the pop that he had stored on his porch. And there are huge fights in much of the United States over wolves. And, you know, ranchers will kill every wolf they see. And what are the attitudes in different parts of Europe toward these predators generically?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer, because we would need to define first what's the audience. You know, the greatest majority of the 500 million people living in Europe live in cities. And if you ask somebody in a city what you think of the wolf or the bear, they love it. Of course they love it. It's like, you know, all Americans love tigers because they live in India and they don't have to face them every day. So if you speak in terms of the global audience of all the North Americans or all the Europeans, the greatest majority is, of course, in favor. But then, of course, you have a conflict, local conflict, with some of the interest group who receive damage from these animals, and farmers are among them. But farmers, even though they are extremely important in the economy of Europe or any country in the world, are just one part of the audience. So they have to learn to listen to the rest of the public. And so, to answer your question, we did a poll on the attitude of people toward bears and wolves in an area where there are wolves and bears, of course, not in downtown Rome. And 95% of the people are in favor of bears. This is central Italy, in the Abruzzo region, where we do have a small population of 60, I mean 55 perhaps, bears, and they live, the distance is a 1 hour drive from downtown Rome. And these 60 bears are beloved by the local people. They don't do any damage, and they have never attack a human. Nobody remember any attack on humans from this bear. So 95 of the people are in favor of bears. When we speak of wolves, the percentage is a little bit lower, but not much. It's 85. So 85% of the people loves wolves and wants to have wolves in the area. So it's only 15% who are against. And those 15% are actually the farmers, the people, you know, have a few sheep or cattle, and of course they have damage. The damage is fully compensated by the state, but that's not enough. Compensation is just one of the many tools to manage the human wolf conflicts. And even though you can repay all the damage done, still the animosity toward the wolf is great. And of course, farmers would like to see the area completely void of wolves. But even there is a distinction. People who have been doing farming in a traditional way, in areas where wolves have been present all the time, that means they never disappear, they have methods to reduce the conflict. In the central part of Italy, for example, in the Abruzzo region, shepherds and wolves and sheep have been coexisting for millennia, and they produced one of the best tools to reduce the conflict, which is the guarding dog, the Maremma guarding dog. If a shepherd knows how to manage these dogs, the damage done by wolves is, you know, in the order of, what, 1, 2, 5, 10, 15 sheep a year, which is a minimal damage. And so the coexistence has been possible. And if you ask this shepherd if they like the wolf, well, they will answer it with a lot of ambiguity. They would say, well, now the wolf is eating our sheep, we should kill it. On the other hand, they say, well, the wolf is a noble animal, it's a beautiful beast, they know their way around, they know the forest, they know how to kill. So you get both answer. And in fact, these traditional shepherds are not against wolf. But then it's another story if you ask the new shepherd, people that have turned into farming recently, they don't know how to handle wolf. And especially, there is a very nice anecdote I can tell. In Tuscany, many people know where Tuscany is, which is the region where Florence is, just north of Rome. The farmers are mostly immigrants from Sardinia. Sardinia is an island off the coast of Italy, in the center of the Mediterranean, and wolves have never been there. So the Sardinian shepherds do not have the wolf in their pastoral culture. They don't know how to handle a wolf. They don't know how to handle the idea of a wolf. They don't know how to handle guarding dogs. So the conflict is extremely high there, because what is missing is the defense tool that the traditional shepherd in Abruzzo have been using for centuries. So now, asking all shepherds to turn back to the traditional methods, it's a bit difficult, of course. So the best way is actually the way forward that I've been preaching for ages, is to define areas where the coexistence is possible with minimal damage, and define other areas where you just get rid of wolves and have your sheep. And this way, we can have sheep and wolves and bears all across Italy, but also all over most of Europe, with minimal damage. I've been speaking too much, perhaps, of Italy, but I can make many other examples of countries that have been growing without wolves, and suddenly see the wolves coming back, and they are now. The two wolves that are in Netherlands, can you think of wolves in Netherlands? which is a flat land with tulips, and you have holes there, and people love it. The greatest majority of the Dutch people are in favor of this comeback. They already have a national action plan, and they are ready to manage whatever comes. There are two or three, I can't remember now exactly, walls also in Denmark, and many walls in France. France was without walls until 1990, when the first two dispersing animals crossed the border between Italy and France. And so France had to relearn how to manage walls. The conflicts are huge. You may read in the newspapers, you know, farmers are really furious. Can you imagine, you know, the threat to the famous French cheese over there? Yeah, so it's a real serious issue. And France spends several millions euros a year in managing this conflict, paying compensation, providing incentives and subsidies to prevent the damage, and so on. Still, the conflict is high, the animosity is high, but if you look at at France as a nation, then the majority of people are in favor of walls. Of course, all those living in cities are in favor. Now you may say, well, but the countryside belongs to farmers. Well, wait a minute. Farming is highly subsidized. Without those subsidies coming from the state or from the European community, without those subsidies, there would be not a single sheep left all over Europe. So in a way, the farmers actually depend on the money paid by the taxpayer living in the cities. So perhaps the urban people may have a say on what's happening in the countryside. Don't you think so?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. what was the low point for wolves in Europe, and when they were eradicated from... Well, so sort of three questions. Have wolves been continuously living in Italy? Two, what was the low point across Europe for wolf range and population? And three, where were the primary reservoirs from which the wolves could then repopulate?
Yeah, I would say the 60s. The 50s and 60s were the low point. Because wolves were killed almost everywhere, and they had been eradicated even before. For example, in France, the last wolf was killed in 1920. In Germany, even before, in 18 something, and in England and Scotland are a story apart, because England got rid of wolves in the 16th century or so, but. And of course, they can't swim across the channel, so the UK is still free of wolves and bears, even though there are plans to bring them back in Scotland, but that's another story. And in Italy, too, the lowest was in the 70s, 60s, late 60s, early 70s, when we estimated about 100 wolves left in the central part of Italy, just close to Rome. That's why we can say that in Italy, the wolves were never fully eradicated. So the population we have now is actually an expansion of those small population left across Europe. You are asking where? Well, the wolves were never eradicated from Spain and northern Portugal, but that's a reservoir mainly for Spain and Portugal, I would say. We don't have any case of wolves from Spain moving into southern France. On the other hand, the Italian wolves have been a reservoir for a lot of expansion. They enter France, they're expanding into France. Two wolves from northern Italy even went all across southern France and entered Spain, and they are now living just close to Barcelona. And the Italian wolves moved north, and we had one wolf moving up to Bonn, which is the capital, the former capital, of course, of Germany. And so it's a long way across a highly, highly human-dominated landscape, and yet the wolves did it very wonderfully, and lived there for a year before being killed by a car. And so the Italian wolves are very important to repopulate France, Switzerland, Austria, the Alps in general. Then we have the large population living in former Yugoslavian countries, which is Slovenia and Croatia, of course, Serbia, Bosnia. It's a huge number of animals, and they are very healthy, and they move north sometimes across Slovenia. Austria is a black spot in Europe. All the bulls and bears that enter Austria have been killed, poached, because legally they are protected, but illegally they have been killed. On the other hand, from Poland, we had an interesting expansion of wolves into Germany. And in 15 years, they went from one pack to the current estimate of about more than 40. I don't remember now exactly the figures. And from these, and the expansion is moving westward into the Netherlands and Denmark. And then we have the northern population. The wolves were eradicated in Sweden a long time ago, but then they had an immigrant from Finland, two immigrants, and they reproduced without much success. And then they had a third immigrant, and that was the shot the population had. And so they increased to the current estimates of certainly more than 300, 350. And still growing, so it's a highly dynamic view for wolves, but we have a less dramatic but even interesting expansion of bears. Of course, the wolverine is also increasing, but the wolverine, of course, is a northern species, though, so only Norway, Sweden, and Finland are interested by the presence of this species. And then we have the jackal that we set aside, but it's a very interesting addition because they are actually making their way across Europe as well.
And I want to talk about jackals in a moment, but I want to just come back to the... I've got two more questions about wolves for now. One of them is this, you know, so much, as you know too, so much of talking about or working on environmental issues is having your heart broken anew every day, whether it's amphibians or, you know, reefs or whatever. But this seems... I'm so glad I contacted you because this is one of the happiest stories that I've had for a long time. And this huge expansion, I just want to say it makes me really happy.
Well, yes, it makes us very happy too. But of course, managing the success is not that much easier than managing, fighting a fight in a trench, like, you know, we conservationists are used to fight to save the last animals or small population or declining population, always bad stories. Now, managing success is not that much easier because people expect that you find a solution to this continued expansion. I think that the most legitimate question I hear from the audience is how many more do we want? And that's a political question, of course. It's not a biological question. I cannot answer. I can give my support as a biologist, and I can have my own irrelevant ideas about the political targets, but in the end, deciding how many more wolves we want in Italy or in Europe, it's a political question. And of course, it depends on the local context. When I say context, is ecological context, is sociological context, political context. For example, the return of wolves into Germany has caused much, much less trouble than the return of the wolves into France. But because the ecology and the economy of these areas are completely different. So I think there is not a solution for all, and we have to find a different solution for every local situation. Equally, I do not mean that the success story of large carnivores in Europe is a lesson for North America. We don't want to teach anything to to anybody, but certainly there is a lesson. Yes, there is a lesson there. The lesson is that it is possible if we change attitude and we tolerate some compromise. Coexistence is compromise. Compromise means that both parties give up something. So we must tolerate a little bit of damage, and we must also manage this large carnivore, perhaps even with some killing when sometimes. Now, to many wolf lovers, just the idea of killing one wolf is just a sort of unacceptable decision. Making the wolf a saint or a sacred animal is actually stupid, absolutely stupid. We are very proud, we are very happy that wolves are expanding, but we should be ready to kill some of them when the conflict is too high or is impossible to manage with the tools that we have now. And this is possible all over. Now, when we look at, I changed my topic a little bit, but just to give you an example. Now, when we speak of India, and we learn that 2,000 people are killed by leopards every year in India, and then you say, oh, well, yes, there are so many Indians. Yeah, there are also many leopards, too, and they coexist. And so there is a sort of compromise, a sort of acceptance, and every country has its own threshold. What I do not accept is that a rich country like United States, for example, would say, well, our threshold is zero. That's unacceptable. I just don't like that. And I think that there is room for a lot of maneuvering on this compromise.
So my other question about wolves, I guess is another two-part question, is we haven't talked about Russia. And are there, when I read stories of 17th century Russia, you hear about a lot of wolves. That's sort of an iconic animal from there. So, how are wolves doing in the larger Russian region? And then my final question about wolves really is, are there significant differences between the wolves in Italy, for example, and the wolves in Russia? Are they very similar, or are they fairly different?
Well, this is a complicated question, because the wolf is one of the most adaptable and flexible animal on Earth. And if you compare the wolf near the North Pole, or the famous wolf of Ellesmere Islands that Dave Meach studied for many years, they are white. They're huge. They look huge, at least. They feed on muskox and hare, and they live in total obscurity at night for 6 months a year, and with temperature of minus 40 or 50 or whatever. And the species is exactly the same of the wolf living in the Saudi Arabian desert with the temperature of 60 above 60 centigrades, of course, and feeding on rats or mice or on small mammals. All the large prey are gone, and is the same species. So there is across this gradient from the north to the south, and the different ecological context, the wolf can be very, very different. Wolves in central Italy, if you look at the size or the weight, for example, is not that different from the wolf in Canada or in Russia. But they look smaller because the hair is smaller, is shorter, is not that cold in Italy like in Russia. And they have a shorter leg. They probably move less. It's a local adaptation, but the wolf is exactly the same. The biology is 100% the same. The ecology is the same. The behavior is the same. And the adaptability is the same. Now, your other question is how wolves do in Russia. That's impossible to answer. In spite of all our best effort to get information from Russia, the information, the data is extremely poor. We think that they are doing quite fine. Most of Russia is desert and with the human density extremely slow. But they are doing fine even in Western Russia. Along the border with Finland, for example, there is a healthy wolf population that used to send many dispersing animals across the border into Finland. Until the Soviet Union system was working, the wolves were killed by national plan. With a national plan and by people paid by the government. And so the population was kept in balance in certain areas where the conflict was too high. When the Soviet Union collapsed, then there was a lack of intervention from the central state, and the wolf population went up. But then soon there was a widespread poaching, and the population went down again. And now it seems there is a new balance, probably due to the fact that many poor areas of Russia have been abandoned. So there is a new opportunity for wild nature to come back.
Before we talk about jackals, and we've got about 10 minutes left, before we talk about jackals, we haven't, you've covered the bears, the wolves, and the wolverines. How are lynx doing generally? The Iberian lynx, you said, is the most endangered cat. How are their trends, and what is the short-term future at least look like for both them and the Eurasian lynx?
Yeah, they're two very different animals. The Iberian lynx is a very, very special animal. It's a smaller lynx, feeds only on rabbits. So if you have rabbits, you may have lynx. If you don't have rabbits, forget about lynx. And the population went down to very small numbers, and very few left in the southern part of Spain. Then the European Union intervened with a huge conservation project. It's probably the most expensive project funded by the European Union. I think it cost more than 25 million euros. And they first set up a captive breeding facility, which has done extremely well. So there are many, many more Iberian lynx produced and available for reintroduction. Some have been reintroduced. And then there has been a lot of work in the few wild areas of southern Spain to boost the rabbit population. So the Iberian lynx was ranked critically endangered until a few years ago. Now has been delisted as endangered. And all predictions agree that in a couple of years, or maybe in 3 years, the population will delist it again to the rank of vulnerable. So it's another success story. It's a very nice story. The Eurasian lynx is another animal. It's larger, bigger, stronger, feeds on roe deer, so and smaller game too, of course. But I mean, can feed on larger animals and can feed on sheep too. So it's a big cause of conflict with farmers. They are increasing too, and there have been a couple of reintroductions, active reintroduction in central Germany, for example, but they have been increasing the population in the Alps, for sure, doing much, much better than used to be in the Dinaric areas. The only areas where they are doing not so well is in Macedonia. It's a small population across the border between Macedonia and Albania, and is still going down. So unless something is done there quickly, probably they will vanish.
So far as jackals, I have to admit that when I think of Europe, I don't think of jackals.
Yeah, nobody think of that. You're right.
And are they filling a niche that was filled by somebody else before who was eradicated, or how is this movement in working?
You know, it's a very interesting because the jackal is an intermediate size, intermediate canid between fox and wolves. And Europe is full of foxes, so there is not a vacant niche there. But probably there is a niche between the two, between the fox and the wolves. Anyway, it's Canis aureus, so it's the African Asian species. So it's nothing new. And it's widespread in Africa. It's widespread in many parts of Asia. And they, we knew that they have been present in the Middle East and Turkey for a long time, and for some time in Greece. This was up in the 70s, like that. Then suddenly they started to expand, and slowly but continuously they expanded into the former Yugoslavian countries, the old Balkan areas. They moved north, enter into the, you know, Bulgaria, Romania, all these areas, and then they Slovenia, and we had the first golden jackal in northern Italy back in the 80s, late 80s. There were very few, you know, just one there. We, actually, people understood that, realized that when we found them dead, killed by a car. Otherwise, nobody suspected that they were around. But now we have very good evidence of the spread of the species, as I say, even in Northern Europe and into Switzerland and some in, even in France. And I bet they will continue to grow.
So we have about 5 to 6 minutes left. And I know you specifically said you don't have lessons for people in the United States, for example, but I am, as I said before, I am, this makes me so happy to hear about these, can you talk more about managing for success, and you, can you talk more about what are some lessons that can be replicated for different battles being fought by different environmentalists around the world? What lessons can you give to them that might help for them to achieve some more successes?
I don't like to preach, you know, so you know, giving this sort of answer immediately sounds like, you know, you want to preach your own recipe and your own solution. I don't have any solution, in fact. As I said, as an example, for many years I've been receiving a letter and calls from friends or from farmers organization from Finland, from Sweden, who wanted to come down to Italy and see how wonderfully Italians coexist with wolves. I told them, you know, you're welcome, I'll bring you around, but there is nothing you can learn, for two reasons. First of all, because the coexistence is not that idyllic, you know, it's not without any conflict. And second, if there is something that works here, it doesn't necessarily work in Finland. As a matter of fact, I believe that it will not work in Finland. Every story, every local situation has its own mix of solutions, a mix of tools to apply. So this is to say that I have nothing to preach. Certainly.
Which is, of course, the only ecological answer, too, because the same thing is true ecologically.
Absolutely true. So we can have make a list of the potential tools. So the first would be the guarding dogs, would be the electric fence, would be the shepherds, of course. You pay a salary to extra shepherds to be in the area, and so on. We can go on with different tools, but how to use the tools, in what degree use this rather than the other one, it depends on the local situation. The only other things I would like to say, probably on this issue, is that there is one word that captures the essence of the coexistence, and this word is tolerance. Most people are just intolerant of anything that causes a problem to his existence. But tolerance, it doesn't mean that you have to stand when a pack of wolves kill all your sheep, or a huge number, but you tolerate if they kill one or two or three, or something you can afford to lose. So tolerance is a way of accepting some disturbance.
Well, a great example of that is, I mentioned earlier, one of my neighbors shot a bear because it got on his porch to drink pop. I mean, first off, put the pop inside, but leave that aside. Second, last year, I would walk outside, and probably over a course of about a week, I had three different flat tires on my truck. And I figured out finally what was happening, which was that there happened to be a baby bear who enjoyed chewing on tires. And I mean, I went and I got replacements for the tires, and the guy at the tire store was saying, oh, that bear would be in my freezer. And it's like, okay, I can understand that, but at the same time, I mean, that's not that expensive a cost for me to be able to see bears every day. And so what I did actually is I put pieces of wood around my truck, so when my truck is just sitting there, the baby bear can't get to the tires, you know, which is the equivalent of finding the, you know, finding a guard dog or an electric fence. Sorry, you were going to say something a moment ago?
No, I fully agree with you. Tolerance means, you know, finding, accepting some damage, find a way to defend yourself, unless you are one of those believers that any source of disturbance should be eliminated. So we would live in a beautiful, empty desert and look around and see nothing but ourselves.
So the last thing I really want to say or to ask is, the other thing that seems very clear here is that, you know, you do a lot of work and the farmers have to have the tolerance and there's all this, but then ultimately, if you just give them a space, the wolves and jackals and lynx and wolverines and bears, they do most of the work of this recovery themselves.
Absolutely true. And this is a bonus and a problem, of course. It's a bonus if you look at recovering population, because they can recover by themselves. Just let them do. Don't kill them, and they will do their job. And the problem is, of course, if you let them do too much, then you will have it in your garden. And sometimes this is a problem.
Well, I would like to just thank you so much for your work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Luigi Boitani. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.